Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on Cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
A Jewish woman fights to recover family artwork that was stolen by the Nazis during World War II in Woman in Gold. Starring Helen Mirren and Ryan Reynolds, it's now playing on demand. Russell Crowe stars in his own directorial debut as an Australian farmer who travels to Turkey to retrieve the bodies of his soldier sons in The Water Diviner, premiering on demand on July 28th.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on Cable. The Art House is now in your house.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting, Streaming Video Unit. I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. In this episode, Allison and I attempt to move past the human form, stepping outside our bodies and into a realm of pure podcasting as we take on Riley Stern's deprogramming drama, Faults.
Later in the show, we'll bring you cue shots where we recommend some titles you can rent or stream at home right now, all centered on a common theme and inspired by Faults. And in the interests of research, Matt actually went out and joined a local cult himself. Not to worry, he's back and totally fine, except for the fact that he now only wears white and won't stop talking about the leader.
The leader is love. The leader is bliss.
Well, good for the leader.
The leader is good.
Well,
the leader gave me Gatorade when I was thirsty.
First up is opening
break. The leader likes opening break.
A segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor,
Movies on Demand on Cable.
In which we spotlight a few new notable films on demand on cable. Matt, do you think you can bring yourself to talk about our picks this week?
The leader suggests I recommend It Follows.
Yeah, It Follows. I think we've mentioned it on the show before, but it's going to be my first pick this week. Really, in my mind, one of the best movies of 2015. I really want to encourage people to see it now that it is available on demand right now. I will read you the plot description. This is from, I believe, the Movies on Demand website. After an innocent sexual encounter, 19-year-old Jay becomes trapped by a vicious curse. It is following her, it in quotation marks, and the only way to save herself is to put others in harm's way. So essentially, this is sort of a ghost STD. When you have sex with someone, they pass this horrific spirit on to you, which follows you wherever you go, but slowly. It does it slowly. You can get ahead of it if you run, if you drive very far away, but eventually, it will always catch back up to you, and when it does, it's not going to do anything good. Let's put it that way.
I used to daydream about being old enough to go on dates. I had this image of myself holding hands with a really cute guy, driving along some pretty road. It's never about going anywhere, really. Just having some sort of freedom, I guess.
Jay, are you awake?
What are you doing?
You're not gonna believe me, and I need you to remember what I'm saying.
This thing, it's gonna follow you. Somebody gave it to me, and I passed it to you.
Wherever you are, it's somewhere, walking straight for you. All you can do is pass it along to someone else.
It Follows was directed by a young filmmaker named David Robert Mitchell. His last movie was the excellent Myth of the American Sleepover, which had this lovely kind of hazy vibe. It sort of felt like a one night in of a teenagedom, but half remembered. So the details were a little bit hazy and foggy. It Follows has a very similar kind of atmosphere, but it sort of tips that over into the stuff of nightmares. And I found it to be very disturbing and scary. I think this could, and frankly, I think should be, you know, this generation's Nightmare on Elm Street. I think it compares very favorably with that. The dreamy mood, that sensation that you're never quite sure if you're awake or asleep. You're trapped inside this nightmare, essentially. You can't wake up. I think it has a lot of kind of nice echoes. It would be a great movie to watch when you're 15 at a sleepover. You know what I mean? Maybe 16 or 17.
Yeah. It would scare the hell out of you.
Oh, for sure.
It's got that kind of urban legend aspect to it.
Yes, it does sound like a story that's been told from one person to the next, and it that you know, and so the logic is just a tiny bit foggy, where you go, well, why would this? But it somehow in the moment it all makes sense, because that's what dreams are. Dreams don't always make perfect sense. But they all kind—they just kind of fit together in their own logic. And besides the fact that it is, I think, very scary, it's also a really rich and smart movie. I've seen it several times. I find more to really admire about it every single time. The take, I think, on teenage sexuality is right on the money. I could very much identify with the character, the male character played by Paul, played by Keir Gilchrist. Paul is the character's name. He is the awkward, sort of lonely boy in this group of friends. And he is so infatuated with Jay, who has this sexual, ghost STD thing, but he is so, you know, sort of infatuated with her that he is willing to risk literal sex ghost death.
And it's not pretty.
No.
That sex ghost death.
No, but he is willing to do it. And it just, I don't know, that seems very like 17-year-old virgin to me.
Well,
I don't know, it seems so dead on the money.
I mean, especially in this world of the movie in which there's like literally no adulthood. Like, we never see the parents that these kids live with.
That's another way it is kind of like Nightmare on Elm Street, in the sense that the parents were always kind of absentee. They were there, but they were never paying attention. You know, they were always kind of like, oh, no, hey, why is there a geyser of blood coming out of my child's bed? That's a little odd. Oh, well. So, yeah, I think it really... It's a great film. I think I liked it a lot the first time I saw it. I thought it was really scary. And then seeing it again and just kind of digging into like yes, it is kind of like ghost STD. You can sort of just narrow it down to that idea. But I feel like it's richer than that. You know, like I think it's a great metaphor for just like trauma, you know, for having something horrible happen to you and not being able to escape it, you know?
Right. And also just for when you become an adult and start to understand mortality as something beyond this very abstract idea, you know, some ways the ghost is just like death, this thing.
Right.
That
or
now
just
is
the death
always...
of innocence and childhood and becoming an adult. Even.
Right. But this thing that's like kind of there coming for you at some uncertain time in the future.
That's right.
You know,
eventually, no matter what you do, where
comes,
you go,
it
it's going to come for you and you just don't know when. That's yes, absolutely. That's I think that's there, too. So it's a really great film. Definitely worth checking out. It's available now on VOD. It is called It Follows. Our next quick pick here is called Lila and Eve, and I hadn't heard of this film until I read the description, but it sounds pretty intriguing to me. I will read you the plot description. The film tells the story of a grief-stricken mother played by Viola Davis, who, in the aftermath of her son's murder in a drive-by shooting, attends a support group where she meets Eve, played by Jennifer Lopez, who has lost her daughter. When Lila hits numerous roadblocks from the police in bringing justice for her son's slaying, Eve urges Lila to take matters into her own hands and to track down her son's killers, and the two women soon embark on a violent pursuit of justice as they work to the top of the chain of drug dealers to avenge the murder of Lila's son. So it's kind of Death Wish or meets sort of a revenge, you know, more of like a Dirty Harry movie or something. It's a very intriguing premise, and that partnership of Viola Davis and Jennifer Lopez sounds pretty intriguing too. So not a movie I knew anything about, but then seeing reading the description, I'm like, I would totally watch this movie. So that's one I've now got on my radar, and I'm looking forward to checking it out soon. That's Lila and Eve. It's available now on VOD. And finally, available on VOD on July 1st, a documentary that I suspect will appeal to some of our listeners. It is called A Lego Brickumentary. And this is a, quote, journey through the Lego brand like you have never seen before. They explore the brick that has captured the imaginations for generations and look at the fundamental question, is it a toy or something more? It seems like the Lego movie has really escalated people's appreciation of Legos, but I mean, Legos are it's crazy how this toy that was, you know, so popular for a long time, but it was a children's thing, has taken on this like larger, bigger place in the culture recently.
And, yeah, especially in having like this whole alt version, right, of games and alt version
and movie
of, like,
mashups.
Right.
And, yeah, I'm gonna make Batman, but I'm gonna do it with Legos. It's like that has become almost like a whole cottage industry on YouTube of Lego versions of things. So the time is definitely right for a documentary about Legos. This one is called A Lego Brickumentary. That's going to be available on VOD on July 31st.
Have you tried a family intervention or exit counseling?
We did, Thanksgiving. The group discourages interactions with family and friends, especially on what they call days of falsities, holidays. We convinced her to come, but it would be okay.
As soon as she saw what it was, she immediately turned violent. There was an anger in her eyes. I don't know if this will make any sense, but as weak as she was physically, emotionally, I saw a strength in her I had never seen. I don't want to lose my daughter, Mr. Roth.
There is one other option. You have here. Are you familiar with deprogramming?
On every episode of Film Spotting SVU, we let you vote on the film or television show you'd like us to review. And in our last episode, we gave you three American indie film options from which to choose: Riley Stern's drama Faults, Patrick Bryce's horror comedy Creep, and Sean Mullen's romance Amira and Sam. And Amira and Sam jumped into an early lead, but Faults fought its way back to win by maybe 4 or 5 votes when we called an end to the voting. So Faults is the feature film debut from writer and director Riley Stearns and stars longtime character actor Leland Orser in a rare leading role as Ansel Roth, a self-described expert in mind control who's fallen on very hard times, kind of hilariously hard times, in part because of a terrible thing that happened in his last big attempt to deprogram a cult member. So he's understandably reluctant to take on a similar case when he's approached by a couple who want to hire him to help their daughter, except that he owes his manager a lot of money. His manager seems to be getting very serious about this fact. He's sleeping in his car. He has no one else to turn to. And so Ansel arranges to kidnap Claire, who's played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who also happens to be the director's wife. And Ansel, Claire, and her parents hole up in a motel room for 5 days in which Ansel will break Claire down and free her from the control of Faults, which is the name of the group she belongs to. Or at least that's the plan. It's no spoiler to say things don't go as Ansel expected. And we'll try and avoid spoiling the twist Faults has loaded in its final part. But Matt, Faults takes place almost entirely in this nondescript motel, in this set of rooms, and we're told more about what the group is like rather than ever really seeing it. Did this make the group more or less compelling to you?
The leader found it just as compelling as it would have been to see it for himself.
It certainly didn't become an issue for me to say, oh, I wish I could see this cult group. I was pretty invested with what was going on in that hotel room between Claire and Ansel, and pretty engrossed by the movie in general. I like this quite a bit, so I wasn't sitting there going, oh, I wish we were seeing the rest of the Faults group or anything like that. I don't think that was really what the movie was going for. I think it was more about this battle of wills, sort of, and also some of the stuff that it's tough to get into without spoiling too much, but generally about the mindset of someone in one of these groups, or the mindset of someone who is susceptible to being sort of taken in by one of these groups. What it takes for someone to sort of give themselves over to a group like Faults, and to be willing, sort of like what makes that appealing to someone. Because I think for most people we hear about cults, we think, well, you know, that they're crazy, they're dangerous, they're scary, why would anyone do this? And I myself included. But I think what the movie really does quite nicely is it shows you by the end of the film, like, not that the group would ever make sense, but that why someone in this sort of position would actually be sort of seduced by what Faltz was offering. That's what I thought. So I thought on that level it worked great. I didn't really need to see the Faltz compound or anything like that at all.
Yeah, I actually really like that you never see that, because I feel like it's one of those things that's very challenging in movies that are about fictional, you know, charismatic movements like that, is mm-hmm. that it can often be kind of disappointing when you finally get to see this, like, this, you know, leader who's swaying people to his will or her will, or just kind of, they tend to look silly, like, despite themselves, because there are certain things we expect from them. So I really liked the ways in which everything about Faltz, the group, was filtered through the kind of very careful descriptions that Claire gives, like using these very vague terms about, you know, we're all students, we teach each other, and there are levels that you can achieve, and like these very kind of like hard to pin down sayings that really make it just emphasize, as you said, that this is really more about the kind of mindset that brings someone to kind of surrender themselves to a whole life, this different life and this different, you know, it's kind of surrender their life as it was before. Yeah, I like this movie a lot too. I thought that like it, especially the scenes between Mary Elizabeth Winstead and Leland Orser, in which they have these very calm conversations that are just very loaded with like power games, that I thought they played off each other really well. What did you think of the kind of framing story in which we see Ansel as this much more ridiculous character than I think he starts to seem in the middle?
I loved the way that the movie was set up. I mean, I didn't really know that much about it. I knew Mary Elizabeth Winstead was in it, and I knew, you know, it was this little independent movie, and that it was about occult deprogramming, things like that. So to me, when the movie opens with this guy sitting in this, you know, hotel diner or whatever, refusing to pay for his lunch, trying to use a voucher that he's already used, and it becomes this, frankly, what I thought was one of the funniest scenes I've seen in any movie this year. I was laughing out loud, maybe partly just because it was so absurd and it was so unexpected in a delightful way, that I really loved that. And part of what I eventually particularly responded to was, you know, it starts off as a pretty lighthearted movie. I mean, it's dark, but in a way, you know, it reminded me kind of a little bit of like a Bad Santa, which is, a movie where it's super, super dark. The lead character is a horrible person. He's down on his luck. He's miserable. He's surly. He's cranky. But there's something kind of lovable or at least enjoyable about watching him suffer and flounder. But then over time, as you said, it does get a lot darker, a lot more serious, a lot more intense. And I thought that was just kind of interesting, because the whole movie is about, you know, programming or deprogramming, and this the possibility of doing that at all, and whether it's possible to take someone who believes one thing and turn them into another, or someone who used to believe one thing now believes another, and see if you can reverse that and bring them back to their original person. So just the idea that this movie starts out as a comedy, pretty straightforward comedy, and then slowly becomes something else. To me, that was like a beautiful way of creating a framework around the movie, where the movie itself is almost being programmed or deprogrammed. I thought that was great. That was another thing that I really admired about it, that the way that it went about that. Very surprising to find a dark drama about cults and deprogramming that has a really great sense of humor.
It's almost Coen's-esque mm-hmm. a bit in the way he seems in
sure.
this purgatory of speaking in half-empty hotel ballrooms.
Yeah, little The Man Who Wasn't There, another Billy Bob Thornton movie.
Yeah.
Basically, Billy Bob Thornton could have played this part, I guess. But yes, I could see the Coen brothers vibe, absolutely.
Yeah, I did also, I liked that in retrospect, setting him up as this slightly foolish character, it kind of emphasizes that in both in like convincing someone to join a cult and in trying to deprogram them, they both involve insisting your reality supersedes the person you're talking to,
right?
Like, it is an act of will, but it is also saying, like, let me crumble your sense of the world, and like then we'll share mine instead.
Mm-hmm.
And that to set up the main character as someone who's like world is already so unstable, and then to have him go into this
right.
is kind of very smart, you know, looking back on it, because even though he turns out to be more formidable than he appears in those early scenes, he is also still someone who's very desperate and who needs to put up this front of self-assurance to basically tell someone that her beliefs are false. She's been manipulated to win someone back.
Mm-hmm. I will say, I wouldn't fault anyone, no pun intended, for looking at those early scenes and saying, well, this guy is a total mess. He's pretty clearly worthless. You know, he is no one you would trust to deprogram your child. Why would the parents hire him to do this? And I do think that ultimately the movie kind of explains that in a way that felt very satisfactory to me, that we don't want to spoil. But I wouldn't blame anyone that sort of found that sort of to be an issue, or perhaps that in a sense kind of gave the game away a little too early for them. It didn't for me, but in retrospect, I could see that. So, I mean, I guess you could sort of take issue with that. And the fact that he is so kind of buffoonish in the early scenes, that perhaps if he seemed just a tiny bit more efficient or useful, have a bit more efficacy in what he does, then that maybe would make the sort of progression of the story a bit more logical. But it's not something I really had a problem with. I wouldn't shock me if someone said that to me, having watched the movie.
Yeah, I guess. Except that also, there's no real, it's not like there's any certification to be a cult deprogrammer.
That's true.
It's also one of those things that is so kind of like both something you choose, it's like self-declared. Your
yes.
expertise in this is self-declared. And then also, you know, he has a track record, like, you know, like it or not.
Right. He's been on television and he's written books. And you're absolutely right. He has a name. I just something that in hindsight I was sort of thinking a little bit about. What did you think of his, I guess we could call him his creditors? You know, he owes a bunch of money he owes it to one character, but sort of the character's emissary, played by Lance Reddick from The Wire, is the main sort of guy who's coming around, kind of the muscle, intimidating him, threatening him, demanding the money that he owes. What did you think of those characters?
I like the Lynchian aspects of them, but
okay.
I did feel that they were essential. I mean, like, they're there to kind of, as to create pressure for this character to kind of force him into something that he
yes.
doesn't feel prepared to do. I did feel like they were kind of interfering with the aspects of the story I really liked, which were what's going on in the hotel room and the kind of increasing uncertainty of what's going on in the hotel room, including what happens with the parents. And when he has to kind of go deal with these creditors again, I was a little frustrated.
Yeah, we're on the same page there. I don't know, the performances there, it's the balance between comedy and drama or thriller or tension or strange, surreal, kind of almost horror-ish elements. That's tenuous. And I felt like the arc of the movie was to start broader and get sort of narrow and narrow and narrow until it got really intense and dark. And it seemed like whenever those characters intruded, even though they're like threatening and demanding money, the way that they're played is so broad that it sort of detracted from that, the smoothness or the sort of that kind of inevitability that you feel as the movie is getting darker and darker, that they sort of snap you out of the spell that the movie is casting. Because I agree with you, you're right. Once you're in that claustrophobic hotel room where literally they like change the doors so that they don't, some of them don't open from the inside so that Claire, the Mary Elizabeth Winstead character, can't escape. You know, you really want to feel that claustrophobia. You don't want, in a way, you don't want to be released. You don't want to get out because it dissipates the tension. So yeah, they make sense for why they're there. As you said, they serve a purpose in the story. But I don't know if there was a more graceful way to use them without leaving that hotel room, maybe phone calls. I don't know what. But yes, I agree. The fact that we have to keep leaving the hotel room to see them, to go talk to them, and these sort of broad, they are kind of Coen's, almost like parodies of Coen's-ish characters, I would say. You know, that they're just not as strong as the Leland Orser and Mary Elizabeth Winstead characters.
Yeah, agreed. And they're just, the two of them are so good together in ways that are not, they're not always as like directly confrontational as you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
I like that so many of their conversations play out in this like very, very earnest fashion, you know,
mm-hmm.
like when he kind of begins by wanting to hear sincerely, like, tell me about faults and tell me about how it works. I did want to also compliment Michael Reagan, who's the cinematographer and who does a lot of really nice work with just some really nice framing and just use of this very limited space, which is done up in some kind of great, like, outdated motel style decor. But he's particularly good with these slow push-ins. There are multiple scenes in which, I think, like one where they're at a diner and one where the two, where Ansel and Claire are talking by the window of the motel room, and then one in the bathroom, that are all just kind of slowly push in on the characters and really kind of emphasize like the growing claustrophobia and kind of focus and darkness that the film is like keeps heading towards. So it's a really good looking film. And I think it's shot in very thoughtful ways that enhance it.
Mm-hmm. It's an impressive debut. I mean, as you said, it is all or largely set in this hotel, in this series of hotel rooms. But this is like one of those, this is a filmmaker, Riley Stearns, who you can see going, I don't have a lot of money. How am I going to use a limited budget and make that an advantage instead of a disadvantage? And the answer is, well, you set it in a place where you can't escape. You know, this is hotel room where everything's going to happen. We're not going to, you know, we're going to trap this person in there and we're going to make you feel trapped with it. So I thought that it's a smart way to use a limited budget. It's something that actually is going to come up with one of my cult film picks later on, that another, you know, recent indie that was like, we're going to make a movie about cults and just, but it's also going to be, it's all set in one place. It's like, you got to know your limitations and you've got to turn them to your advantage. And I think that this movie shows a guy who's smart enough to know the budgetary limitations he's under and to turn them into real strengths. I think that, even despite those scenes where they leave the hotel, it does have this wonderful claustrophobic vibe, which eventually becomes very nightmarish. And like I said, it almost becomes a full-on horror movie by the end of it. And I thought in a way that was extremely effective.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, in knowing what you have to work with, you also have these two actors, Leland Orser, who, like, does some great work here, and then Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who I'm assuming this role was kind of tailored
written
for her.
Yeah. Sure.
And she does great work within it and kind of slipping and being someone you can never pin down.
Yeah.
Every time you think you understand her character, you realize very quickly you don't.
Very, very beautifully ambiguous where you're trying to get, well, it puts you in the position of Ansel, right? You're trying to read her. How into this cult is she? How much does she believe? And, you know, and then any moment where she seems to kind of snap out of it and crying to her parents, mommy and daddy, and you go, oh, is, you know, you're, it really leaves you completely on uncertain footing, just where you should be to really enjoy it. So yeah, this is something I was very pleasantly surprised by. Would definitely recommend other people check it out. It's only like 90 minutes. It's you know, brief but very effective. It's a good sort of like, you know, something to watch it, you know, on an evening. Just it's a nice little funny but surprisingly kind of spooky movie too.
Yeah, I really liked it as well, and I would recommend it. That is Faults, and it is now streaming on Netflix. About cults, Matt.
Right, not cult films.
Exactly.
Right, movies so the Rocky Horror Picture Show you want to talk about today, and The Room, and that's what we're talking about.
That's definitely not what we're talking about.
Okay, let's just pause the recorder for a few minutes so I can find some other movies to talk about. No, I'm just kidding. Movies about cults.
Movies about cults. A fairly small group of films, though I will say it's impressive the number of great directors who have made movies about cults.
Mm.
You know, Eyes Wide Shut.
Sure.
Rosemary's Baby.
Yep.
The Master.
The Master, yes, a great one. That's on Netflix right now.
M. Night Shyamalan's The Village.
A masterpiece, if ever there was one.
And then, you know, you've got a lot of interesting smaller films like The Wicker Man or Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. It's a very potent topic,
mm-hmm.
if one that I think not everyone knows what to do with.
What does that mean?
I don't know. I think that, like, it can be silly, too.
Can be silly,
you know? And
but as you said, a lot of great filmmakers have done great things with it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's a topic I find fascinating. I mean, don't have a lot of, I don't have like a lot of experience like reading books about it, but it's like something whenever I see a movie that's about it, I'm like, oh, that sounds, I'm going to watch that. You know, like Faults, when I saw that come up and it's really what it's about, I'm like, oh, that sounds interesting. So like picking this as our subject and, you know, like getting to watch one of these movies that I hadn't seen before, I was, you know, totally, totally engrossed. It's fascinating. It's like, what will, you know, the whats are interesting, but also the whys, I think, is what, you know, the character motivations, the stuff that Faults is really about, like the what drives someone to join one of these groups. What right. does it take?
Well, and also even the idea that there's a relief in surrendering, you yes. know, in surrendering your life to someone who tells you exactly what to do
right.
and what's going to happen. And
who has the the answers,
exactly.
because there are so many questions in life that are so unanswerable. So, you know, you're searching for something, and when you find that person who says, here it is, this is the answer, and, you know, that giving yourself over to that, you can see the appeal.
Absolutely.
That's why I started following the leader.
All right. Well, would you like to go first?
Sure. Well, you know, there's that old adage, right, that truth is stranger than fiction. That, I think, is certainly true with religious cults. So I wanted to make sure I had at least one documentary in here to get a real cult group in here somewhere. So my first pick is a film called The Source Family. It's from 2012, directed by Jody Will and Marie Demopoulos, and that's currently available on Netflix. And The Source Family was this Los Angeles hippie group that, have you ever heard of them, Allison? I didn't know anything about them.
No.
And you're from California.
I am from California.
So,
Northern California.
Okay, oh, excuse me. My apologies.
It's
so,
a big state,
it's a very large state. Well, neither of us had ever heard of it, but there is this documentary about them, and they really have this fascinating history that is well chronicled in this movie. The Source Family grew out of The Source, which was one of the first health food restaurants in Los Angeles and was wildly popular in the late 60s and early 70s. You know, celebrities and movie stars used to come and eat there. Supposedly, it made thousands of dollars every single day, and the owner of the restaurant, this guy named Jim Baker, was a former Marine, former Hollywood stuntman, expert in jiu-jitsu. He had killed several men. He had served time in jail. Eventually, he had gotten into the restaurant business, supposedly with money he allegedly, maybe, possibly got from robbing a couple banks. No one is ever sure. They talk about this in the film. And then he opened this restaurant. And this was at the height of the hippie movement. And Jim Baker started really kind of digging these hippies and admiring them and liking their lifestyle. So he began hiring them for the waitstaff of the restaurant. He began kind of practicing the hippie lifestyle himself. He grew out his hair, started dressing like a yogi. And little by little, the Source restaurant and the staff became the Source family, who at first kind of looked to Baker for spiritual guidance, but then ultimately worshipped him as a god. He renamed himself Father Yod and Yahowah, and he had many, many wives.
As you do.
As you do. Well, he's God. God should not be limited. That's why you become God. God, if you're going to be God, you should have some perks.
Gotcha.
Yeah. What I found particularly fascinating about the Source family, but about cults in general, is the mindset of a person that leads them into a group like this. And that's something that I think the Source family, the film, gets really well, because it has lots of interviews with former members of the group talking about the experiences, both good and bad. You know, the when we talk about cults, it's typically things like brainwashing and violence a lot of times, the dark end of a lot of these cult groups. But without spoiling too much, the Source family definitely went down a very different path than that. And the foundation of this cult, or this group, whatever you want to call them, in the very beginning at least, was this sort of preaching this idea of, they're hippies, peace, love, be kind to everyone. And, you know, that's not a terrible philosophy. That's an admirable philosophy, you know? So I think that there's something interesting to this, that the way that, you know, that high ideals, which a lot of these groups often have, that they always seem to inevitably, eventually give way to darker impulses, like, you know, having 13 wives or something like that. So this doc, I think, does a very nice job of chronicling that thoroughly, fairly even-handedly. I don't think it's too judgmental at all. If you want to judge these people, I think that's, you can do that. That reading is available to you. But I don't think the movie is judges them too harshly. And it has a lot of great and interesting archival footage of the group. They documented a lot of their lives in the 60s and 70s. So I found this very interesting. If you are interested in the topic of cults, religious groups, movements, things like that, this is one you should check out. The Source Family, that's available now on Netflix.
All right. Well, my first pick is also available on Netflix and works as a kind of interesting double feature for Faults. It is called Holy Smoke, and it is from the great Jane Campion. It's her 1999 movie co-starring Harvey Keitel and Kate Winslet. Campion co-wrote this movie with her sister Anna, which is interesting. It's reminiscent of Faults in its basic setup in that it is about a cult deprogrammer named PJ Waters, who is played by Harvey Keitel in cowboy boots, who's hired by a suburban Australian family to fix their daughter, Ruth, who is played by Kate Winslet, and who was out backpacking in India when she fell under the sway of a guru named Baba. And she took on a new name and she, you know, started wearing saris and kind of declared that she had found herself out there and was going to stay there, set her plane ticket on fire. And the friend she was traveling with immediately goes home to Sanssouci, a suburb of Sydney, where her parents are horrified and hire this man and lie to their daughter and say that her father is dying, has had a stroke while visiting their friends out in the outback, and she needs to come back and come back and help him. So she comes back and is instead brought out into the middle of nowhere by Harvey Keitel's character, who attempts to convince her that, you know, she's been under the sway of this charismatic leader and that she is, you know, basically being manipulated. And something that I really like about this, beyond the fact that it's funny, like it's a much funnier film, it's the moment when Kate Winslet's character reaches enlightenment, they're at India and you see when the guru like points at her, you see her third eye open and she's like in this like kind of this imagery that that's I don't know, supposed to evoke like this kind of stoned version of a kind of spiritual enlightenment, but that it's also. It also very clearly allows open the idea that she's not under the sway of anything particularly malicious, that, you know, the idea that a cult, your cult is just sometimes just the religion that you don't understand, right? Mm. The line between religion and cult is a fuzzy one.
Yes.
And the way it portrays the Australian suburbs as this kind of grotesque experience in which her parents are, you know, like just living in this house with all of their family kind of rolling around and dogs, and the father clearly like cheats on his wife, and the they're like her sister-in-law is also like kind of obsessed with film stars and feeling sexually neglected. There's just like there's a general kind of bit of like garish misery there that suggests that maybe running off to India is not such a bad thing after all. But the movie comes down to a kind of duel between Winslet and Keitel, and it's maybe less interestingly, I would say, becomes one that's like a battle of the sexes, but also becomes one in which, and there's a flicker of this in Faults as well, that Winslet's character starts using her sexuality as leverage, you know, and the power struggle is like really well done, even if I think the movie doesn't quite stick its landing. It really kind of digs into that idea that there is a fundamental arrogance in being like, you are, you know, you were brainwashed and now I'm going to fix you by restoring you to normalcy, especially when the normalcy that you see is not so great. It's a really great performance from Kate Winslet in particular, who's like very brave in this and does some great flaunting of armpit hair and Keitel as well. And like a lot of Jane Campion films, the sexuality here is also very like kind of provocative and very kind of feminine, female focused, which is something that always feels like very refreshing and different. So that's Holy Smoke, which I liked a lot, even if it's I didn't love the ending. And it is now streaming on Netflix.
All right. It's funny that you describe that as an ideal double feature with Faults, because I had the exact same feeling with my next pick, which I thought would also make a great double feature with Faults. It's another indie thriller from the last couple years about the world of cults and the nature of faith. It's Sound of My Voice from director Zal Batmanglij and co-writer and star Britt Marling. And Britt Marling had a bit of a moment a couple of years ago where she was the new Sundance it girl. She was writing and starring in all of these different movies, including Another Earth. Of all the things that she's done so far, and I've liked some of them, Sound of My Voice is definitely my favorite. It's about this couple who are making a film about a Los Angeles cult, not entirely unlike the Source family. They've lied their way into the organization, which they are filming with hidden cameras. They're trying to expose these people as frauds. And the husband, who's played by Christopher Denham, has an ulterior motive in the whole film and is very much a skeptic. But the more time he spends in the organization, which is led by this woman named Maggie, played by Britt Marling, he begins to basically question his own questioning. Maggie has this outrageous story that she's traveled back in time, that she is there to save a select group of people from this horrible apocalypse that is going to ravage the Earth in the near future. But she is really charismatic and kind, and there are all these little details that begin to make him sort of drawn to her and doubtful of his own beliefs. And we talked about this with Faults, but what I really admire about Sound of My Voice is the way that it tells a huge epic story on this tiny low-budget scale. The movie is about dark futures, alternate timelines, science fiction, cults, and it probably cost very little money. I mean, it all takes place mostly in an ordinary suburban basement. And, you know, you asked before about Faults, about, well, does the fact that we can't see these things affect the movie? And you could ask the same about Sound of My Voice, that we never see the future that Maggie is talking about. And I would argue that really works perfectly into the themes of this movie, which is this exploration of religion and belief. Believing things that you can't see is the root of all religion, right? Catholic people believe in heaven and hell. They haven't seen it. They just believe that they're there. Jews believe that Moses spoke to a burning bush. Personally, I have never met any chatty shrubs, right? But that's what belief is. And I think that Sound of My Voice, in addition to being a really effective thriller, is also a really thoughtful meditation on that idea. You have Maggie, Britt Marling, telling you these things and saying them with the utmost sincerity, and it's, do you believe them? And of all the movies that I can think of that have come out in the last 5-10 years, the one that I would probably put at the very top of the list, the most I would like to see a sequel to, I think Sound of My Voice might be the number one, because there is a lot more to explore here. I would want to spend more time with Maggie, her followers. There's a bit of a cliffhanger at the end of the movie. I think the movie was probably designed to be more of the start of some kind of franchise of some kind, whether it was online or on television or in films, whatnot. But I would love to see another Sound of My Voice. But in the meantime, I'm going to recommend, if you haven't seen it, that you check out the first film, the only film at this point, Sound of My Voice. You can rent that at a variety of different websites, including Amazon and iTunes.
It's interesting. I would never want to see a sequel to that.
Really?
I really like it, but I love the way it
ends. You like the ambiguity.
Yes, and I also like that, you know, I mean, you said you never see the future, but if you ever did, that would be a very different movie.
True.
It would be a movie about people who are, basically pulling a Terminator 2.
You're right. It is a bit of a catch-22, where you're really interested to find out where they wanted this story to go, and also a little fearful that...
Yeah, that, I mean, it keeps you balanced so perfectly every time,
right?
Being like,
maybe it's real, maybe it's not, maybe it's real.
Like, there is a scene, I won't go into too much detail, but it involves a cranberry song that is like my favorite scene in the movie.
Right.
And it so perfectly encapsulates that dilemma of,
right,
like,
what do you believe?
Right.
Right.
Yeah, it's so good. Well, okay, for my next pick, I wanted to pick a movie about a cult that was without a doubt bad. and the one in this one is certainly bad. My next pick is Martyrs, which is available for rent on multiple platforms. Pascal Laugier's 2008 French film. I will recommend this with the caveat that it has probably the most disturbing, sustained graphic violence, maybe of any movie I've ever seen. And all of it kind of with stripping out like any sense of like fun action or like gross out gorehound sensibility. Like all it is there is to be like relentless and disturbing. So also to explain the premise of Martyrs is in some way to spoil it, mm-hmm. as the film is set up in this kind of disjointed way where you only understand the kind of terrible things you've seen happening like over halfway through when someone comes in who kind of finally explains them. So forewarning there, if you don't want to hear this, feel free to skip ahead. But the premise of Martyrs is that it is about a secret cult of people who believe they can find out the truth about the afterlife by creating martyrs, by kidnapping and torturing young women until they reach this state of surrender, of euphoria. And I think that when you finally see this cult after having started with these two girls, one of whom was kidnapped as a child and escaped, and like who is just very traumatized in adulthood, it is like the terrible, organized normalcy of this cult that is one of the most disturbing aspects of the film. That they are, the film kind of like, it starts off with one of the characters murdering with a shotgun, like a suburban family of four. And you start with the family of four. You see them talking and hanging out and having this like really kind of like breakfast table conversation. And then she comes in and kills them all. And for a while you think she's just insane. And that she, and then you realize that, and then you understand that no, they actually are part of this organized cult that is participating in like just grueling torture. And I think the premise of this movie, as much as it's a movie that's very difficult to watch, the premise of the movie is fascinating. It is the idea of, as the kind of the woman who's the head of it, head of this organization says, it's all only too easy to create victims. And they keep in their efforts, they keep creating victims, people who are just suffering. And what she's looking for is something more. And that something more involves this kind of state of transfiguration. And in most conceptions of a kind of religious order, any kind of extreme religious order, and Martyrs has like a kind of half, like a kind of halfway alliance with religion. In the pictures of martyrs that we see, some of them are just regular, or some of them are atheists, some of them are not religious at all. But like in any portrait of like of cults, it's usually the people themselves who are aiming for this transfiguration, you know, that we think of like something like Heaven's Gate and people who all kind of you know, committed mass suicides in order to try attempt to reach some higher plane of existence. And I think what is introduced that is so kind of like devastating in this movie is that the people in Martyrs are attempting to make other people reach this higher plane for them. That there is this kind of innate, like, you know, rather than anyone being a volunteer to try and reach ecstasy, this kind of religious ecstasy, terrible kind of a religious ecstasy, that they are using innocent people for it instead. And there's some kind of awful wrenching about of kind of ideas of spirituality in that, that the movie answers in a very dark way at the end. It is a really horrific film. I think, in all of the French extreme, new French extreme films, this is the one that I think kind of, basically they're like, it's after this, it's over. Nothing can top it. But the reason that I think it works beyond just being notorious is that it has this idea that is so kind of compelling and so awful. Like it's this cult is based around an idea that's basically philosophical. It's this idea that you can glimpse the afterlife through the most terrible human experience, and that that's something you inflict on other people. So yeah, with caveats, I definitely recommend it. If you have not seen Martyrs, it is worth a try at least once. I don't think it's a movie that you will find yourself reaching for again and again. And if so, maybe don't tell me about that because that's a little disturbing. But it is available for rent on multiple platforms, and I do think it is worth a look. That is Martyrs.
In the right hands, the relationship between man and suit is symbiotic. The suit has power. The man harnesses that power. You need to be skillful, agile, and above all, you need to be fast. You should be able to shrink and grow on a dime, so your size always suits your needs. Now dive through the keyhole, Scott. You charge big, you dive small, then you emerge big.
All right. Before we get to Behind the Eight Ball, let's talk about some new movies currently in theaters. They are available in theaters right now as we are speaking because we haven't seen next week's big movies yet. Allison, what segment is this
again? Matt and Allison's
completely concise, totally succinct new release roundup. Nothing.
Right. There we go.
You said it.
Yeah.
Everyone heard her say it. So what's in theaters right now that you want to talk about, Allison?
Well, we've got Ant-Man, the new Marvel movie.
Okay.
Long awaited. And one that came in with a bit of baggage, given that this was the movie that Edgar Wright developed for years and then walked, then left.
For years.
Yes.
I was at Comic-Con in 2006. '06, when they introduced, here is Jon Favreau, he will be making Iron Man, and here is Edgar Wright, he will be making Ant-Man. That's how far back that goes. And it then at the last minute, basically, they replaced him, or rather he left.
Creative,
he was not happy. Right.
Yeah.
Creative differences.
And I feel like you can see that in the movie in many ways. It's still got this like ghost of an Edgar Wright movie in it.
Yeah.
It's filled with a lot of Edgar Wright jokes that it doesn't get quite right. No pun intended. and it is, I don't think that any, as much as there are still some charming bits to this movie, I don't think that any Marvel movie to date has felt as encumbered by its responsibilities to the Marvel universe.
I wouldn't agree with you on that count. I would say Iron Man 2 probably felt even more obligated, having
I'll
just
be
rewatched.
Honest, I don't,
you don't remember,
remember
it. I just, you know, when I sat through all however many hours of Marvel movies earlier this spring, that one remains to me just the most shamelessly kind of like less interested in its own movie and more interested in the other movies coming up. But that said, I do think that there's a comparison you could make because there's a lot of business in this one.
And it doesn't match, which is the thing that I think is...
Yeah.
Like, when you have your movie start off with a flashback to the 80s that ties in, like Peggy Carter, who's great, but, like, no one cares.
It has nothing to do with the movie,
nothing
really.
Nothing to do at all. It's just there to, like, have it, yeah.
This is the question that I'm really... Because I think we agree 100% on this movie, that it has some nice moments. It's not terrible, but it's just... I found it to be pretty bland.
Yes.
Why does... Do you know the Rotten Tomatoes score of this movie?
No.
If you had to guess, what would you say... What do you guess it is right now at this moment as we are recording this on Sunday afternoon?
65.
79%.
Why do so many people I think, who are like, it wasn't that bad.
But you say that, and you're right, that Rotten Tomatoes is not a gauge of, like, excessive excitement. It is a gauge of, you know, yes or no. That said, a lot of our colleagues really enjoy this movie. And I wonder, why do you think that is?
I don't know. I mean, I think that in the final act, when it finally goes into, like, the bits of, like, two tiny people fighting each other.
Yeah.
There are some, like, very satisfying moments.
Okay.
Even though I again, like, it's hard not to watch them and not see, like, the better version that Edgar Wright would have done.
Right.
I don't know. I don't understand people who think that Evangeline Lilly's character is somehow a well-written character. Like, that whole storyline is basically, maybe the next best thing to actually having a female main character is to have a whole storyline about how she's more competent, but does not get to be the main character.
I completely agree with you. And I'm in the middle of writing something about this. That character flat out almost offended me because you could say what you want about, you know, like the Black Widow. There's a lot written about the Black Widow in the Avengers, but at least she's a member of the team. She gets to do stuff. She's important. right? We care about her. This whole movie is like the character you're talking about, Hope. This is the daughter of the original Ant-Man, and the original Ant-Man, played by Michael Douglas, is he refuses to let her do anything, and there's a reason in the story we won't spoil why.
It's not a satisfying reason.
But it's not. It is essentially, basically, it is a character or an arc that's basically put on screen to, it's almost like Kevin Feige. They always ask him every movie, when are we getting our female superhero movie? And he always comes up with these excuses and reasons why. It's like they put that into the movie. And I have heard people say, as you're talking about, that, oh, it's so interesting how they wrote that into the movie and how she's fighting against these male, you know, this oppression that these men are putting on her. And it's if she actually ultimately got to do something in the movie,
right,
maybe I could see it. But basically, it is essentially just winking at sexism and just being like, aren't we silly? We don't let these women do anything. And yeah. I found that a lot, even more galling than just not letting her do very much.
Agreed. Especially when part of, almost like the joke that I would assume it comes from Edgar Wright for this movie is that this is a character who's like not even part of this like grander battle of good and evil. Like
right.
He's so like minor.
He's literally
in his own
this
life,
little
basically.
Tiny little thing.
Yes. And all he cares about is getting visitation rights for his daughter. Like he ultimately ends up doing some version of world saving, like
right.
all superheroes.
Yes.
But like what he cares about is like getting
small.
To, yes.
Which is appropriate because it's Ant-Man.
Yes. Yeah, I know. It's frustrating because it's like it felt like such a missed opportunity. Like,
yeah.
At this point, like a Marvel movie also can't be that different, it feels like, or can't be standalone.
But even Guardians of the Galaxy
know,
had a lot
was
more character.
Anomaly. I feel like that.
That had so much more character
know,
than this.
I know.
You
I
know?
Just, but like, I, you know, ultimately, they need Ant-Man to be part of like the Avengers, right? Like,
right.
And I'm like, I don't care about that. Like, I don't, Avengers are already pretty full.
I could hypothetically care about it if they made this character fun and interesting, which I didn't really think
that
they did.
And, like, I really like Paul Rudd, and he does a good...
Super
like,
wasted.
But, like, that character has no personality at all.
No.
Yeah, I know. It was a waste.
All right, so we're in total agreement on Ant-Man. Very quickly, Trainwreck.
I liked it a lot.
You liked it a lot.
I did. I feel like there is like a bit of a weird tension between Amy Schumer's sensibility
and
like
Judd Apatow's
like monogamy is the answer for everyone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
But like it's kind of an interesting tension, and I think ultimately I really liked seeing Schumer have a movie like this, and I liked her. I liked the relationship she has in it.
Yeah, I think it's definitely the best thing Apatow's done in a while. I enjoyed it. I didn't love it. I agree with you that tension that's there. I don't know. I guess it's interesting. I think at some points it becomes a little. I don't know. It just gets in. It gets in the way of the movie.
And
essentially,
he has, like, a fundamental conservatism that I think
clashes a little bit with her.
Yes.
Sensibility.
Yes.
I agree with you. I think it's also, it's an Apatow movie. He's infamous for making long movies. It's super long. It should have been shorter. Like, I don't even understand. LeBron James is in the movie and super funny, but there's also another subplot involving another basketball player, Amari Stoudemire. And I guess it's there because it's set in New York. They needed a Nick, although the movie is so insanely dated. That's maybe the funniest joke in the movie, is that the Knicks are good in this movie, which is hilarious. But I don't understand why they didn't condense that into one character.
It's definitely a little ragged, like all Apatow movies.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, it is the first Apatow movie in a long time where I haven't felt like it's trying to sell you on this idea of domesticity that is actually like hell.
Right.
You know, like I'm really glad that he's moving away from, frankly, these super personal stories and letting kind of like other like collaborating
right.
in this case.
I think it's great that he sort of used his clout, his name, to give Amy Schumer a platform. I like her a lot. I hadn't seen a ton of her stuff, but I like, you know, I love her comedy. And I thought, like, I wasn't sure, could she really carry a movie on her own as a lead? And I really thought she pulled it off. And
she's very funny.
She's very funny and good, too. There is a scene set at a funeral that I actually found pretty affecting and genuinely emotional, and really was, I thought, straddled a nice line of being funny and actually being, you know, sad. And like in a way that very few comedies are allowed to introduce, you know, ideas about death and sadness and grief.
Agreed.
And,
yeah. Well, I mean, and there's another scene where she essentially picks a terrible fight with herself, like not even with the guy she's, you know, with Bill Hader's character, but like he kind of is there, but she's mostly picking it with herself. And it's so kind of like
believable and like emotionally raw and like you want to cover your eyes.
Yes.
And, like, she handles it really well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. I think it definitely announces her as a talent that should, you know, keep making movies like this. Absolutely. So yeah, it's good.
Yes.
Solid. Definitely would recommend it over Ant-Man. I'll
absolutely
say that much. All right. Well, let's get to Behind the Eight Ball. We're going to wrap things up here with some recommendations for streaming movies. Three new releases, two listener recommendations, and one film chosen blindly by number from our My Lists. Allison, you want me to go first?
Yes.
All right.
All right. Well, three new releases.
Okay. First up, a big recommendation for fans of documentaries about Hollywood and movie production. It's called Lost Soul: The Doomed Journey of Richard Stanley's Island of Dr. Moreau. Bit of a mouthful on the title there. This Dr. Moreau is from 1996, infamously one of the worst movies and most troubled productions of the 1990s. This documentary tells the inside story of it all, has extensive interviews with the film's original director, Richard Stanley, who was replaced during production by John Frankenheimer. Just incredible stories of cinematic chaos, of Marlon Brando basically being insane. There are these unbelievable Brando stories. It's incredible. Just a great behind-the-scenes doc. You will sit there with your mouth just open, agape the whole time. I did want to mention, we also had a listener recommend this title. Nathan Smith wrote in to say, this is a recommended movie, and I have seen it, and I agree with Nathan. You should check it out. It is called Lost Soul: The Doomed Journey of Richard Stanley's Island of Dr. Moreau. It's a very long title. It is available on Netflix. Next up, another solid documentary new to Netflix. This one is called The Search for General So, and it's about a dish I would assume most listeners like myself have eaten many times, never thought about for a second, but it's General So's chicken, and the doc is about, who was General So? Was he really a fan of this chicken? Why did this dish get named after him? Who invented it? And while the film is kind of investigating that, it charts the history of the Chinese food industry in America, which is also kind of the story of the Chinese immigration and Chinese immigrant experience in America. And I found this a very interesting documentary. You know, it's something I had never really thought about before, and that's fun to find a documentary about a subject you didn't even think you would necessarily be interested in, and then you do it. You see it, and you are interested. So big thumbs up for that one for me. That is The Search for General So. And finally, a mild recommendation, very mild. This is General So's is way too spicy for this recommendation, for The Expendables 3, which is now on Netflix and on Amazon Prime. It is easily the weakest of the three Expendables movie, which is saying something. It has perhaps the least satisfying action of the entire franchise, which is also saying something. But look, you're not paying to see it if you have Netflix or Amazon Prime, and I would say on that condition, it's worth checking out for two main reasons. Mel Gibson is a fantastic villain in this movie. Do you remember the name of his character, Allison?
No.
Conrad Stonebanks. Number two, Antonio Banderas, who is a great underrated action star from movies like The Mask of Zorro and Desperado, but rarely makes action movies, has a really funny supporting role in the film. He is a lot of fun. And there's this guy who I don't know if you've heard of, Allison, named Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's in it as well. I know, it's a weird name. He probably should have changed it to something like Arnold Strong. That probably would have been a better alternative. But he has a really, a funny small supporting role as well. Him and Jet Li have a couple of really great scenes, which I don't want to spoil for anyone. So it is not a great movie. But if you are a fan of the other two movies, if you're a fan of the people that I've mentioned here, I think they make it just barely worth watching when you don't have to pay anything extra. That's The Expendables 3. That's now available on Netflix and Amazon Prime.
All right. Two listener recommendations.
This first one is from a listener whose name is J.M. Bossy, which is one sweet, sweet name. J.M. is writing from Vancouver, Canada. He writes, I'd like to make two quick recommendations for streaming, both genre films I feel explore themes with subtle poignancy. The Gray stars Liam Neeson and was received with mixed reviews back in 2012. Still, I think it is an interesting movie that is both well-edited and well-acted, especially by Neeson, who translates his recent action dad grunts into a much more distressed and somber performance centered on his will to survive. And for my fellow Canadians, last year's The Drop was critically well-received, but was pretty much entirely overlooked by Year's End and is now streaming on Canadian Netflix. Though the story is perhaps a little straightforward and the film is an unquestionably slower burn than most, I feel there is real value to everything on screen. Again, love the show and can't wait to hear your thoughts on Faults. Thanks for the great show. That again is JM in Vancouver. Thank you, JM. Next up, I've got a recommendation from Rosalie in Naperville, Illinois. Hi, Allison and Matt, Rosalie writes. Thanks as always for the great and entertaining show. Here, she actually sent in a bunch of recommendations, but in the interest of expediency, I'm going to just pick this one, which is Way Down East from 1920, a silent D.W. Griffith masterpiece that stars Lillian Gish as the naive Anna, who is easily manipulated by ladies' man and all-around asshat Lennox Sanderson, played by Lowell Sherman. By the time she realizes the full extent of his awfulness, she must flee to a new place to escape her new reputation as a loose woman. Of course, no one's past can stay buried forever, and Anna's happiness and love life are threatened at numerous points, culminating in an unforgettable sequence shot in a snowstorm. Anna's life is at stake when she stumbles onto the icy river and begins floating towards a waterfall. A dangerous chase and rescue sequence across the ice chunks follows, and no stunt doubles were used, so that makes it even more impressive. The movie contains both drama and humor, and Lillian Gish is a proto-feminist before that was even a thing in the story about men being free to sow their wild oats while women suffer the consequences. It's well worth a watch and available on Netflix Instant as well as Fandor. Thanks for the show. Looking forward to the next episode. That's from Rosalie in Naperville, Illinois. Thank you, Rosalie.
All right, and one from your My List.
Well, I'm going to cheat because you gave me number 99, and guess what, Allison?
You'd already talked about it.
No, I only have 98 films on my list right now. So I used number 98. I hope that's okay.
Maybe.
All acceptable. Right. Depending on what it is. Well, it is the PBS series The Mind of a Chef, which is hosted by David Chang, the great chef of many restaurants I like, and I know you do too, including Momofuku and Ma Pesh. I guess the show is about the mind of a chef. I don't honestly know much more than that. That's why it's at the bottom of the list, but I'm a big fan of David Chang's cooking, so I was curious at some point to catch up with this show. So that's number 98 or 9 on my list. If you want, I'll just go add something at random, which there would make it number 99 on my list.
Wow. This will do for now.
Yeah, that's okay. You'll allow it. All right, great. Thank you. Are you ready to go with your countdown here?
I am.
All right, let's start with three new releases.
All right, first up is a film that I haven't seen yet, and it actually is the kind of film that seems perfect to catch up with on Netflix. It is The Sweet Blood of Jesus. Spike Lee showed up on Kickstarter in 2013 with his first Kickstarter campaign, I believe, for a vampire film that he insisted would not be a remake of Blackula. It turned out to be a remake of Ganja and Hess, a lesser-known film about a man who develops a thirst for blood after being cursed by an African artifact. And this is not a film that got great reviews. Spike Lee has not necessarily been on a consistent kick recently. But it is certainly an interesting curiosity, which is why I have added it to my list, and maybe you will as well, now that it is on Netflix. Also new to Netflix is Tig, which is a Netflix original doc. It's one of two recent docs about comedian Tig Notaro, who in 2012 was diagnosed with breast cancer, at kind of like topping off an almost hilariously terrible run of bad things that had happened to her, including contracting pneumonia and then almost dying from the medication she had to take for it, and then the sudden death of her mother due to an accident at home, and then the end of her long-term relationship. And so a few days after this diagnosis, coming on the end of these terrible months, she did a stand-up set about it at Largo that immediately became legendary. And then Louis C.K. helped put it, like, release the audio for it. And it basically reinvigorated Notaro's career, even as she started touring again, even as she was dealing with breast cancer. And so Tig is a doc about that, and one that kind of manages to balance tragedy and humor in a very kind of effective and poignant way. So that's Tig, now on Netflix. And finally, new to Crackle, Cabin Fever 2, Spring Fever. essentially a direct-to-DVD sequel to Eli Roth's debut about kids in a cabin dealing with a terrible flesh-eating disease. And not the kind of thing I would usually suggest that you pay attention to, except this one was, notoriously among horror fans, directed by Ty West, the indie horror darling of such films as House of the Devil and The Innkeepers, and appropriately, a movie about a cult called The Sacrament, his most recent one. This could have been, you know, West's, like, I don't know, move on up out of the indie circuit, I guess, maybe. But it didn't work out that way. And he apparently tried to have Cabin Fever 2 be a John Waters homage, which is an interesting approach. Maybe not surprisingly, the producers battled with him. And ultimately, he tried to have his name taken off the movie, but was not allowed. So it still apparently got most of what he shot. It just was meddled with. And if you're curious, it is free on Crackle now.
Okay. How about two listener recommendations?
All right. We have one from Vanessa, who writes, "Hi, Matt and Allison. Netflix just made one of my very favorite childhood movies and one of the loveliest animated movies ever available for streaming, The Last Unicorn. With the recent passing of Christopher Lee, who voices the movie's villain, King Haggard, I thought this would be a perfect time to look at The Last Unicorn. With its medieval tapestry-style animation, excellent voice casting, and storylines that don't follow the convention of animated fairy tales from most Western animation studios, The Last Unicorn remains a movie that continues to enchant me as an adult. It was the first movie that ever made me cry. And looking forward to many happy hours on the couch streaming an SVU recommendation." Thank you, Vanessa. That is a great recommendation. And then we got a recommendation from Mercedes in New Orleans, who writes, "I wish I had more time to come up with something eloquent to say about Darius Moore's documentary, Evolution of a Criminal. The film shows one man's experience in the criminal justice system. It is both uplifting and devastating. The film is technically diverse, employing haunting shots, reenactments, and close-up interviews which borrow heavily from Errol Morris. But the real joy of this movie is the story that draws you in. It is so compelling and introduces us to a cast of characters who represent diverse views and perspectives. It resists all the trappings that films about the criminal justice system fall into. I'm a longtime listener since 2009, and I haven't written in a long time due to a lot of life changes. I hope you find the time to watch this. I think it is well worth it." I mean, you sold me. It's going on my list. Thank you, Mercedes. That is Evolution of a Criminal, which is now on Netflix.
Okay, and one film from your my list.
You gave me number 73, which is Agnes Varda, From Here to There. I'll read you the description from Netflix.
Please.
Perky octogenarian film director Agnes Varda documents her world travels, making unexpected connections between the far-flung destinations. It's like a five-part, I think, TV documentary series. So basically, it's an Anthony Bourdain show, you know, with Agnes Varda, except that Varda's friends that she goes to visit include, like, Alexander Sokurov, Carlos Regadas, and the late Chris Marker. So, you know.
Sweet.
Yeah.
So as we get into our listener choice options for our next episode, let me just explain what's going to be going on here, because it's going to get a little complicated. Brace yourselves. So our next episode, we're going to record a little bit early because in 2 weeks... I'm going to be on vacation. So the window that we would normally record in, we can't do because I'm not going to be here. So we haven't decided what that episode, the next episode, is going to be. It's not going to be a listener's choice review. Although if you have some ideas, we're willing to hear them. We have a little time to decide. So if you have something you would want us to talk about, a theme, a movie, a TV show, something, feel free to write into us. Let us know. We may very well take your idea. SVU at filmspottingsvu.com is the email address. So these listener's choice options we're going to talk about now are for 2 episodes from now, a month from now, approximately, and you're going to have a little bit more time to vote. And we picked things that actually none of these are available to watch now, but by the time we're recording that show, they will be available. And we decided to do a TV-themed episode since there was a couple of interesting-looking upcoming shows. And I have the first one here, and it is Wet Hot American Summer, First Day of Camp, which will be available on Netflix starting on July 31st. This is the, I would say, long-awaited, although I didn't think this day would ever come. It is sort of a sequel to the great cult comedy Wet Hot American Summer, but it is a TV series.
It's a prequel.
It's a prequel. Right.
No, they make a lot of fun out of that.
Right. It, because it includes the entire original cast 15 years later playing the same characters, even though it's a prequel. So... I'm sure there will be a lot of ridiculous humor about that. But really, they have an astounding number of stars from the first movie back. I think just about everyone. I'm not even sure if there is anyone that didn't come back. But we're talking about Janine Garofalo, Paul Rudd, Christopher Maloney, Ken Marino, Amy Poehler, and Bradley Cooper, both of whom were in the original movie and now certainly much bigger and more famous than they were when they made this.
Apparently, Bradley Cooper, they scheduled all of his scenes for like 1 or 2 days.
Right.
So he could like fly in and shoot them all and then go.
Yeah. And the list goes on and on. It has an unbelievable cast. I guess it's 8 episodes. On Netflix. I am very much looking forward to this. It has, you know, the original creators, Michael Showalter, David Wayne. They are completely, it's their baby once again. I hope it is great. I'm really looking forward to it. So that's option one, Wet Hot American Summer, first day of camp, and that's going to be on Netflix starting on July 31st.
Okay, our next pick is another comedy series. It's one that has already aired on FX. And one that I liked a lot, and it's coming back for a second season on FXX on September 30th. So it's a good time to catch up. It is You're the Worst, the comedy series from Stephen Falk, starring Aya Cash and Chris Gere as two just horrible people, like awful Los Angelinos who, despite themselves, end up in a kind of carefully negotiated accidental relationship. And it's one that I thought was really well done. And I think it's going to be on Hulu. The first season is going to be on Hulu on August 10th, at least according to Hulu's PR person. So we hope that works out. And really good time to catch up with that, with the second season coming out. And it's a really funny show. I like it. I like mean people.
I haven't seen it.
Well, there we go. Make Matt see this show.
All right, well, that's option two. And option three is another show that I haven't seen, but that's because it hasn't premiered yet. It is a new show on Hulu, and it's supposed to be debuting on August 5th. I don't think the entire series is going to be debuting then. I think we read that a couple of episodes will be debuting then, and then it's going to be playing weekly. So Hulu's not going with the Netflix route and putting everything up. They're doing the typical TV route and releasing things weekly, I suppose. But we'll review as much as we can at that point. And it's called Difficult People. And the description of it that I have here says, this Amy Poehler-produced comedy stars Billy Eichner and Julie Klausner as best friends who live in New York and frequently land in hot water as a result of their ostentatious behavior. So it's basically the Alison Wilmore and Matt Singer show. They're playing us, I think. That sounds like us. Buddies who land in hot water as a result of their ostentatious behavior.
It's definitely us. We're really ostentatious.
We're super ostentatious.
And we definitely go outside a lot.
Yes. We go out and do things. And
all the time.
Don't just sit around watching streaming movies and eating ice cream.
Definitely never.
That's
do that.
Not us.
Yes.
So some very talented people there. Amy Poehler producing, Billy Eichner, Julie Klausner. Very, very funny. So another very intriguing option here. These are all very, very strong options. But that one, again, is Difficult People on Hulu starting on August 5th.
So which of these TV series would you like us to review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Units? You can send your pick to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com or enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Don't forget, we're going to have another episode in between before we get to this. So we're giving you a little more time to vote. Your vote must be received by Monday, August 3rd at noon. And after that, we'll be announcing the winner on Twitter at our Twitter account, at FilmSpottingSVU. And you'll have all that week to watch the series, or as much as you can. And then join us for our conversation on the next episode, which will be on Tuesday, August 11th.
FilmSpottingSVU is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies and TV shows we discuss on the show. The Film Spotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. You can listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com. We will be back in 2 weeks with more recommendations, probably more TV recommendations, perhaps, since it's going to be a TV review. We'll see. Who knows? In the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Alison Wilmore, at Matt Singer, and the show itself, which you can follow at Film Spotting SVU. That is where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice and where we share more streaming suggestions from SVU listeners. And we'll probably be throwing out some possibilities for this interim episode we haven't figured out yet. So be sure to be following us as we try to determine what that in-between episode is going to be. For Film Spotting SVU, I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Alison Wilmore. Thanks for listening.